You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Tyler.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. So you're in Oklahoma, land of my birth.
Indeed. Yeah, on the other side, though. I'm on the Tulsa side.
You're in Tulsa. Yeah, I was born in Lawton. Oh, well. Yeah. Then I guess we can't get along after all. But let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Tyler Johnston, the founder of the Midas Project, which does investigations of the kind that we will talk about. Lately, you've been doing some work that sheds light on what you could call, I guess, broadly speaking, the AI lobby, in particular, one group that is funded by a super PAC, that is funded by Greg Brockman, president of OpenAI, Mark Andreessen of Andreessen Horowitz, and I think one of the co-founders of Palantir, Lonsdale, is that right?
That's right, yeah. And Ron Conway is the other funder in there.
Now, what's his claim to fame?
That is a good question.
Just funding a nefarious super PAC. That's what it says on his Twitter.
That's the new one, yeah. But both him and Lonsdale are like small fish compared to the 50 million given by Brockman and A16Z.
I see. Okay. So yeah, 25 million each. Brockman and his wife ponied up for 25 million for this group leading the future. That's the super PAC. And then some of the stuff we'll talk about was done by a group that the super PAC funds called Build American AI. And some of the work we'll talk about involved a collaboration between you and the well-known journalist Taylor Lorenz as well. So before we get going, why don't you say a little more about what the Midas Project is? When did you start it?
Yeah, it's just over 2 years ago that I founded the Midas Project. Mm-hmm. And we are a watchdog nonprofit that does a mixture of investigative research and public advocacy to hold the frontier AI companies accountable, specifically kind of the big six like OpenAI, Anthropic, Meta, Google, etc. Uh-huh. So our kind of biggest project so far and our claim to fame was our work on OpenAI's nonprofit restructuring last year, where we just did a lot of kind of in-depth, deep dive research and writing into the history of that organization and organized a large open letter and did some other work to try to kind of shift the course of that restructuring, or if not change it, at least create some more public knowledge of the stakes of that effort.
Maybe we could delve briefly into that. Now, did you have a particular finding or revelation? I certainly have questions still about that. Of course, OpenAI began as a nonprofit and pretty famously, in light of the lawsuit by Elon Musk, has transitioned to not just a non-nonprofit, but soon to be a publicly traded company. They've now filed, I think, for their IPO.
That's right. Yeah.
What did you guys find?
We have, our biggest report on this was like a 14,000 word website we launched called the OpenAI Files. That mm-hmm. It's kind of a long history of this organization. I would say that like some high level reflections I have are that I don't think that they communicated transparently about the stakes of the restructuring or the implications for the public, both in terms of the sort of economic entitlements the public had. Mm-hmm. The nonprofit was at one point entitled to all the money that OpenAI made. And then at a later point, it was like entitled to all the money above a set cap. And now it's, 26% of the money. We'll see where mm-hmm. it goes in the future. As well as like some genuine kind of safety provisions that, it was structured that way because the founders were so worried about what profit incentive would do to their ability to make hard decisions when mm-hmm. the time came. And yeah, I think we've lost some of those protections.
Now, it's funny. Now, Elon Musk's complaint was that they kind of, I guess, got his money under false pretenses because he made the biggest donation by far to get the thing rolling as a nonprofit. And then he felt he had been cheated out of something. Now, I don't totally get that, because my understanding is that donations to nonprofits are not something you can expect to make money off of or have any claim to do that. It's not an investment. It's like But that aside, here's the thing I don't understand about the OpenAI side of it. I mean, I run a nonprofit called the Non-Zero Foundation. I don't know how many zeros you would have to take off of the assets that OpenAI, the nonprofit OpenAI, wound up controlling to get to the value of Non-Zero, but it would be a lot. You know, it's a very, very small thing. But I wound up talking to a lawyer at one point about, I guess, I don't know whether it was in the context of going private or anything, but my understanding is that if you're going to become a private company, you know, you have to reimburse the nonprofit for any assets that are transferred, right? And the thing is, at any given point, before OpenAI has made the transition from nonprofit to profit, I would think the sum total of its assets is, in theory, its total value as implied by the latest round of investment, right? Like, that's what the latest round of investors are saying. When they say we raised $30 billion at a valuation of $700 billion, what they're saying is these investors think that the company is worth $700 billion. That, in other words, it's current, in a sense, it's current assets, as I understand it, that their ultimate market value or something is that much. So it seems to me, if you were going to like leave the nonprofit intact and say, but we are now a for-profit company, which is what happens, you should in that case give the nonprofit $700 billion in cash. Now, I must have something wrong, right? But that's the common sense interpretation of the basic way the law works, right? I know. No, what am I doing wrong here?
Your instinct's totally right. And in fact, I think this is like a useful tool to kind of think through, like how did this happen? Certainly, it would be true that if Non-Zero went for profit, I think it would have to get the full value. Historically,
which is $650 billion, by the way, not $700 billion. But,
So yeah, I think it's because it happened in a kind of like step-by-step process and a lot of smaller decisions were made that diluted kind of the nonprofit's ownership in a sense of the for-profit enterprise. So like the first conversion, and this is, I think, the primary one that Musk was suing about. And I should mention, by the way, we were subpoenaed in that case. OpenAI was accusing us of being funded by Elon Musk to like wage PR war against them, which was not true. You know, we can get into that if you want to. It was interesting.
If he wants to fund somebody, I'm available.
But, that's what I said as well. Yeah, like here's our account number. So yeah, the 2019 initial restructuring was where like the nonprofit was like, okay, we're going to create a subsidiary for-profit company. Mm-hmm. You're going to have complete control of that company in terms of like our like, yeah, ownership rights or control rights. Mm-hmm. But we're going to let other investors come in and give capital, and they can like actually see returns on that investment. And because they were worried that like as soon as you involved other investors who could see returns on a subsidiary LLC, it was, or I think it was an LP originally, mm-hmm. and it changed to an LLC. You know, they were worried that if the investors saw unlimited returns, they would have a lot of sway in the future. So they said, okay, investors can see returns on the subsidiary, but those returns are going to be capped at 100x their initial investment. Right. So if you put in $1 billion, you could get $100 billion back, but that's all. That cap eventually changed in like 2023. They quietly said, okay, this can raise by 20% per year, which is, you know, double like what you would make in the market under ideal conditions if you were investing in index funds. And eventually in, you know, 2025, when this restructuring to a public benefit corporation finally happened, they were weighing the nonprofit's future entitlements to, you know, above cap profits against investor interest in this subsidiaries, the subsidiary mm-hmm. LLC. And, you know, depending on how you crunch the numbers there, which would have been a fun job for the investment banks because they had to price the value of AGI or superintelligence. And I would mm-hmm. love to know what those like 25-year-old investment bank employees were thinking when they were doing that spreadsheet. But, you know, they had to make a guess about, in plausible futures, how much money would the nonprofit make versus those investors. Mm-hmm. And what they came up with was 26% is what the nonprofit would make.
So I guess maybe the problem, you know, because the basic, when people say, what does it mean to be a nonprofit? Does it mean you just can't like get rich by starting one? Actually, no. You can in principle have a very big salary. I don't have one, but you can have a very big salary. My understanding is what you can't do is distribute profits. In other words, actually have a stake in how profitable the thing becomes the way investors do. So I guess the fatal loophole here is whatever law allows them to start a subsidiary that actually does distribute profits, right? I mean, right away, you've kind of violated the whole principle. And I guess it's after that that things get even worse without technically breaking the law. But anyway, what do I know? So they succeeded. I can see why Musk feels abused, but I don't think he has any claim to get any kind of actual financial relief of any magnitude. That's my judgment as someone who knows absolutely nothing about this. But anyway, let's move to the subject at hand. Now, I first became aware of this whole body of work you've done on the AI lobby or this particular part of it via this recent story about a sock puppet Twitter account that, there are a couple of such accounts. This seems to have been a fake Doomer account, and it has been associated by you with a group called Build American AI, which is funded by Leading Future, which, as it happens, I had written about in the Non-Zero newsletter in a slightly different context, complaining that the guy who I guess kind of runs Build American AI, named Nathan Lemur, was getting a little McCarthy-esque, I thought, in the way he was trying to associate, in this case, Bernie Sanders and some other people with, the Chinese Communist Party, by virtue of the fact that they had done like an online dialogue with some guys in China, right? It just seemed, they're trying to, this was about AI. And of course, Bernie Sanders would like to see some regulation, and the whole point of Build American AI is they don't want much. And so anyway, they tried to tar them as being, kind of aiding and abetting the enemy or whatever in, I thought, not so subtle way. So I'd written about that. Now, tell us about, let's start with this one sock puppet account that looks like it's supposed to be run by an actual AI doomer.
Yeah. So, this is the handle of his account, and it's still up, is Jonathan Doomer. And the name is John Doomer. There's a profile photo that just looks like some random middle-aged man. In fact, it is probably an AI-created amalgamation of Eliezer Yudkowsky and Dario Amodei, which is...
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I'll have to take a closer look. That's great. I'm not sure I want to see what that looks like, but I will look.
Yeah. It has been posting for a while now. The account was created, I think, last September. Build American AI launched in October. Around the time that Build American AI launched, this account started posting about AI pretty nonstop. It even mm-hmm. retweeted the announcement tweets from Build American AI that had like 200 views. And so, they didn't try very hard to like cover their tracks if someone did dig deep into this. But, they were posting on a near daily basis. And by November, the account had firmly taken on the persona of an extreme AI doomer that is like very worried about this technology. And I think this is like the archetypical opponent that Build American AI sees themselves mm-hmm. as having in the regulatory sphere. And so, you know, there were times when it would like tweet out in support of the RAISE Act, for example, which is the bill that Alex Borres authored. And of course, Leading the Future is spending heavily against Alex Borres, presumably because of his role in authoring that bill.
He's a guy who perhaps ironically used to work at Palantir. But anyway, now he is running for office as someone who wants to regulate AI. And so the lobby has kind of taken out after him.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, like when Governor Kathy Hochul signed that bill into law, this fake Doomer account retweeted it and said, people are saying that the RAISE Act slows innovation. Correct. That's the feature. Which, of course, no supporter of the RAISE Act says. This is like a... This is the super PAC failing the ideological Turing test and, you know, coming up with...
Although their claim, I mean, their defense is, hey, it was obviously a joke, right? We were satirizing a... Isn't that what Nathan Leamer said? We were clearly satirizing a doomer and we hadn't worked hard to conceal our connection. I mean, remind us what you just said about how they hadn't seemed to take great pains to... What was the kind of smoking gun about the connection again?
Yeah, I mean, it really wasn't a true smoking gun in the sense that, like, even when we published, we couldn't definitively say that this was happening. Okay. It just was very circumstantial and it looked this way. It was that, you know, they started posting about AI in the same two-week period that Build American AI announced its public campaign. They retweeted Build American AI's announcement post. At one point, they responded to Nathan Leamer. But that's about all. And it required me going back 500 tweets in this account's history, trying to find out what was going on with it. Like, who is this person? What are they doing? Mm-hmm. So it was not obvious. As far as I know, Taylor and I, this piece, I should say, was co-authored with Taylor Lorenz, who writes the User Mag Substack. And
your Substack that the Midas Project puts out is called Model Republic. So a lot of this can be found there.
That's right. Yeah. This story was cross-posted on both of those. And, you know, as far as I know, we were the only people ever to have made this connection. Like, we were the first. And so, like, it was not obviously linked to Build American AI at all. There were easy steps they could have taken if they wanted to disclose it, including just putting it in the bio, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. It was not obviously a parody. For one, and someone only pointed out to me a couple days ago, but Twitter has a thing when you create an account, a little checkbox that you're meant to hit for parody accounts. And it puts a little like disclaimer on the account saying that this is a parody account. They didn't do that. And then most of the tweets they were doing, you know, they were taking on fairly like weak straw man-ish positions that are easy to attack. Mm-hmm. But most of the, they had some tweets go viral. Some tweets get hundreds of thousands of views. And most of the people commenting clearly thought that this was an authentic doomer and were kind of like dunking on it and treating it as if this is actually one of their ideological opponents.
Which, when you think about it, makes sense as something that Build American AI would want to do, right? I mean, set up something that can be readily dunked on but is taken seriously as a doomer.
Exactly. Yeah. And indeed, like some of their, you know, supposed jokes really weren't funny. Like there was one time they responded to a podcaster who was, you know, issuing a grave warning about the threat of AI with an image of like an assault rifle, essentially, and the phrase, "We don't call 911, which is, you know, kind of a sense of like, we're going to defend ourselves with violence. And if this is a joke, if this is what it means for them to like have a laugh on Twitter, you know, I don't think any politician wants to be like touch them with a 10-foot pole.
Right. I saw that. That was the first one I saw. And, you know, I would say, look, even if it were true that this was meant to be taken as a parody account, obviously, you know, tweets go out, tons of people see them. Obviously, a large chunk of people are not going to look at this and go, oh, it's a parody account. And this is, you know, in a time when there has been violence committed by opponents of AI. Apparently, somebody threw a Molotov cocktail at Sam Altman's house and bullets were fired at the house of some politician somewhere. You know, they're putting out this image of an assault rifle. I mean, come on. That's like, it's bad at so many levels, but certainly one of them is to you know, is to falsely provide false evidence that one more doomer is actually thinking about violence. I mean, that's just kind of stunningly irresponsible. And just, you would almost think it's just kind of stupid too, because like, what's the upside? And it shouldn't take a lot of imagination for them to see that this could get them into trouble with people, right? Like this Nathan, could we pause and talk about Nathan Lemer? Who is this guy? I don't want to defame anybody, but he's just this group he runs, Build American AI, is up to so many different kinds of mischief, apparently, that I find problematic.
It's my belief that the core of leading the future's operations, and I kind of use leading the future and Build American AI interchangeably because they are kind of two sides of the same political machine. Mm-hmm. Nathan Lemer is more in charge of the Build American AI side, but he is like a targeted victory person. He was formerly the vice president of Targeted Victory, leading the future's.
What is Targeted Victory?
It is a GOP consulting firm that is kind of like, yeah, one of the big Republican firms that I'd say the majority of their work is probably with political campaigns, helping Republican politicians win elections. I think they also do work with brands trying to curry political influence. And obviously, in this case, the AI industry leading the super PAC. Uh-huh. And yeah, they like, now this is probably like the fourth or fifth example of this sort of astroturfing we found. And so I think it's pretty clear that like they're open to these strategies, the way that they are going to handle the sort of popularity problem that AI has is to kind of create some favorable grassroots engagement that takes their side. And so in the case of these sock puppet accounts, yeah, we had this like false flag activist. And it's so funny to say that. Like, you know, I didn't really think that this is a thing that happens. You know, people say like, oh, there's false flag Antifa activists or something. And normally I'm like, oh, it's just a conspiracy theory. But yeah, here the AI industry had a false flag activist. Mm-hmm. They had another sock puppet being run at the same time by the same vendor that was like a kind of pro AI account. And that one was equally toxic, right? Like it was going out and espousing the benefits of AI, but also attacking industry critics. So multiple posts called out kind of anti-AI protesters, including one that called out the specific organization Stop AI by kind of comparing them to people with disabilities, like reposting videos of real people with Down syndrome or other disabilities and saying like, POV, you're at an anti-AI protest, or this is so heartwarming, I hear that this is what Stop AI is doing or something. So, you know, just really toxic stuff. I think it's like to try to curry some amount of favorable conversation that goes viral, because that's what it takes to go viral these days, is some amount of controversy. And goes viral while taking their side of the argument.
Yeah. And then there was this, you also uncovered, I think, this fake journalistic organization that actually was populated by AIs. Not that you couldn't be a journalistic organization that was run by AIs. And I'm sure we'll see more of it. But in this case, it was, what was its connection? Now, was it representing a number of kind of, I don't know, right-wing positions or something, one of which was related to AI? What did you find out about this? How did this come to your attention, and what do we think we know about it?
Yeah, and I should mention, when I published this story and the sock puppet story, it was all based on circumstantial evidence at the time, and the stories would say, like, this is my best guess for who's behind it and what's happening. Now, Build American AI has admitted to both of these on Twitter. You know, this fake news site run by AIs, Leading the Future has admitted that it was a vendor of theirs that had been running this platform. And they say they've terminated the contract with the vendor and that they weren't aware of it. I don't know if I believe that or not. but I became aware of it because Nathan Calvin, who is an attorney at the AI advocacy group Encode, he forwarded me this email he got from a reporter named Michael Chen, who was writing for this publication called The Wire.
I think supposedly named Michael Chen will in the end be the appropriate qualifier, but go ahead.
Indeed, yeah. But yeah, in the email, he you know, introduced himself as Michael Chen and said, I have a number of questions for you. He wasn't willing to get on the phone. He was only going to do an email interview. He was emailing from an address that said reporter@acutuswire.com, which would be a very strange convention if you ran a publication with many contributors, because are they all sharing an inbox or something? And like, he also, you know, in the text of the email, he's like, oh, I'm writing a piece about, and then he just gives the whole title of the article. It's like, that's the last step in the editorial process. Like, why are you giving your interviewees the full title of the article you're writing?
Yeah.
Anyway, so something seemed off about it. And so I looked up this site and it was weird. Like, it had come into existence 4 months earlier. And in those 4 months, it had published 94 full-length articles. It said that it was expert source journalism and independent reporting. You know, it really gave off the sense that there were lots of human contributors who were all independent and telling stories that were, you know, important to them in some way. And Michael Chen's email was 100% AI generated, by the way. You know, I ran it through PanGram, which is this new AI content detector that has a remarkably low false positive rate. And so when it says something's AI generated, there's a very good chance it is. And it was. As were the majority of the articles on their site. I think only 3 of the 94 articles on their site came back as human authored. Everything else came back as AI authored.
So what kind of articles were they? And by the way, the guy who sent you the email, who had been approached by, quote, Michael Chen, you said he's part of an AI advocacy group. Is that an AI safety group or a pro-AI industry group or what?
Yeah, they're more on the safety side. It's like a youth group called Encode that...
So was the idea to interview him, do we know? And like, I guess we don't know. And make him look bad or just to feature him
in... a hit piece. Yeah,
Because
they were asking specifically about this piece of AI legislation in Tennessee. And, you know, they were like, the questions were insinuating that this was going against Trump's agenda, that it was, you know, being funded by effective altruists or doomers or something of the sort. And so like, yeah, presumably the reason that the piece was going to be about this was because Leading the Future had some stake in this fight, or the people associated with it. And Encode, I imagine, would have been their adversary. I don't actually know the details of Encode's activities, but yeah.
You know, it's so funny. So Build American AI is set up by Leading the Future to counteract people who are worried about the impact of AI. And if you ask them what kinds of dangers they're warning about, one thing they'd say is, well, you can imagine a situation where some AI bot posing as a human approaches someone and blah, 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 blah. And then, like, they set this up, right? Yeah. They do the exact thing that people are warning about. Yeah. That their opponents, in fact, are warning about. I mean, how dumb is that? That's why I keep saying, like, who is Nathan Lemur? And why was he hired for this job? I mean, look, I guess if you think nobody's going to uncover anything you do, then it's not irrational to do stuff that would look pretty bad if exposed. But the other thing is, like, people worry that the people in charge of AI are not risk averse enough. Well, Nathan Lemur sure doesn't seem very damn risk averse, but I digress. Go ahead.
I agree. And I think this is why, you know, OpenAI has started taking a lot of steps to distance themselves from the pack. And I think it's for this very reason that, like, among the kind of anti-regulatory camp, there's a growing consensus that the industry has failed to tell a positive story about how AI is going to impact people's lives in a beneficial way. And the fact that the largest political operation associated with this ideological camp and with OpenAI and A16Z is, like, really, yeah, providing the example of the AI dystopia, I think, is a huge own goal. As you point out, it's almost hard to imagine. And so, yeah, we've seen, you know, OpenAI... 2 days before we released our article about the sock puppet accounts, they released a statement saying, we are not associated with Leading the Future. This is Greg Brockman donating in a personal capacity. We have no visibility into their operations, which, by the way, I have reason to doubt. But, you know, they claim that they don't know what Leading the Future is doing on a day-to-day basis.
It seems like they're not They're not very good at preventing visibility. That's one of their problems. So Greg Brockman, again, he's the president of OpenAI. So technically the money doesn't come from OpenAI, but he's the president of OpenAI. And if you ask why he has enough money to be giving it away like this, it's because he has a stake in OpenAI. And again, he is the
president. He did an interview with Wired where he was asked about this donation and said that he made it in service of OpenAI's mission. It's been reported that Chris Lehane, OpenAI's chief lobbyist, advised Greg Brockman on this donation. And
really?
And to people in DC, this is like not surprising, because I think that many companies have done this strategy where like it's strictly better to have the donation go through your executive, because in DC, the politicians will understand. They'll be like, okay, OpenAI's president gave me a huge donation, so I should, you know, treat them with baby gloves and take meetings with them and stuff like that. Whereas if you're, you know, donating to Trump, for example, and you're a Silicon Valley company and all your employees are liberals, it lets you like wash your hands of it to those employees, or maybe to a future Democratic administration that would have, you know, taken umbrage about this. You can say, you can like get the benefits today in DC of having a corporate-affiliated political donation, while preserving the optionality to another audience say, oh, that was just this one executive in their personal capacity.
Yeah. I don't know. It just seems like, I mean, if you're going to embrace a generally nefarious enterprise, embrace it more nefariously. In other words, like it seems like it wouldn't be that hard to generate $25 million in a more diffuse way. You know, there's so many investors in Silicon Valley who have just a ton of money and have an interest that overlaps with OpenAI's interests as so far as regulation goes. And, you know, it wouldn't be that hard to informally arrange for a number of them to cough up $2 or $3 million. But I guess if exposed, that might look even more insidious. I don't know. But it's a funny, I was surprised to learn, I think reading one of your pieces, that it would be misleading to call this an industry lobby, in the sense that some of the stuff they do paints OpenAI's rival Anthropic in an unflattering light, right?
That's right, yeah. And in fact, I think people widely understand, for example, Alex Boras's race, the New York 12th Congressional District, to now kind of be a proxy war between Anthropic's affiliated super PAC and OpenAI's affiliated super PAC, with the kind of ideological distinction being that Anthropic is a bit more pro-regulation and the OpenAI A16Z PAC is a bit more anti-regulation. And, you know, because Boras authored AI regulation, Anthropic is supporting him, OpenAI is opposing him. So,
yeah, I want to talk later about Anthropic because it's not totally clear to me. I mean, I guess they are certainly more pro-regulation than OpenAI. But I remember when there was a bill in California that kind of, I guess the Scott Wiener bill that was one of the first prominent AI regulation bills. And at that point, and for all I know, that was an unduly restrictive and bad bill. I don't know. I have nothing, no knowledge of its contents. But I think I remember that even Anthropic didn't really embrace it, right? Yeah. Like they kind of said, they kind of didn't denounce it. But
that's right. I think Anthropic is more pro-regulation on the whole than OpenAI. Mm-hmm. But in particular, it's like a narrow scope of, you know, certainly they're China hawks and they want the industry to go very quickly. And you would think that that would go hand in hand with deregulation. I think Anthropic just wants to see like a smaller set of protections around catastrophic risk, which is kind of what the RAISE Act does. It deals with the safety plans that these companies have to prevent weapons of mass destruction and that sort of thing. Although that, as you point out, that is what the bills in California dealt with. And in fact, Anthropic, I forget the sequence, but indeed, I think they initially opposed it and then kind of gave a begrudging, like, this seems better. This seems like it's probably positive on the on balance, but we still have concerns, or something like that.
Now, Taylor Lorenz did a thing. I mentioned earlier that I had a piece in Non-Zero where Building American AI, well, specifically Lemur, in, via his Twitter account, seemed to be kind of trying to tar certain AI safety people as like pro-communist or something, or pro-CCP, because they're engaging in dialogue with China. Of course, a lot of people think that you're ultimately going to have some dialogue with China. In fact, even the Trump administration has initiated a dialogue with China over certain aspects of AI safety. Anyway, I mentioned that, and I gather Taylor Lorenz, who's been your co-author on some of this, uncovered some kind of astroturfing operation that has something to do with China.
That's right.
Yeah, how did that work?
Speaking of the incompetence of this operation, the way that she discovered this paid influencer campaign is that I believe the marketing agency that was running it, which was called SM4 or something, they reached out to her, this journalist who has, you know, a specialty in covering kind of social media and social media influence campaigns. And they DM'd her and they asked, would you like to make paid content for Build American AI?
So this was an operation that basically hired influencers to send messages it wanted without their connection to it becoming publicly known. And one of the people they approached is an expert in uncovering exactly the kind of connection they didn't want uncovered, kind of.
Yeah, that last part is right. Yeah, and so it's very sloppy, but indeed, yeah, they were paying social media influencers to spread messages favorable to them, which are, you know, pro AI and anti China messages specifically. Mm-hmm. I think the details about disclosure are that, like, it's up to the influencer to mark the post as an advertisement, and many of them don't end up getting either marked as an advertisement or having the specific funder disclosed. And I think in this case, a couple of the examples that Taylor drew on, the influencer did mark them as advertisements but didn't disclose that they had been part of this Build American AI campaign. But yeah, like, certainly I think a lot of this work is done with kind of the expectation that there's going to be imperfect adherence to the disclosure norms for paid content.
Okay. So have we covered the main things you've recently uncovered, or am I forgetting a piece about something or other? You've done a lot of work.
Yeah. So they paid a large number of pornographic Twitter bots to go out and engage with their content on Twitter.
To engage with content generated by Building American AI, or?
Yeah, and this one I should caveat. This is my belief. I think it's very likely, but they haven't admitted to this one. So
what's the value of getting your tweets liked by porn? spell this out for me a little.
Yeah, the porn bots thing is like I still don't totally know what the deal with that is. I have a couple theories, but in general, like, paying for engagement is not new, because on the one hand, you know, the Twitter algorithm looks for engagement, and if a post is getting a lot of likes and retweets, it might show it to more people. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, people look at engagement to get a sense of like how popular or influential a certain message is, and you know, there's various reasons they might want to look more popular and influential than they are. Maybe the operatives running it want to look better to their funders. Maybe the whole operation wants to look better to DC. And so having hundreds of retweets, which, you know, some of these posts got hundreds of retweets from these bots, that looks a lot better than having 5 retweets.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's no mystery to me why you would want to look popular and influential. I've been trying to do that for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that part makes sense. This is the most sensible thing they've done, is to try to look popular and influential. Go ahead.
Yeah, and then there was also another sock puppet account that months before I had written about that, again, they didn't admit to this one, but it seems overwhelmingly likely to me that they also ran this third sock puppet account. Mm-hmm. And I should mention, by the way, that like one of the reasons I believe that OpenAI has visibility into this operation, despite denying any visibility, is that these two most recent ones that Taylor and I wrote about, both of them were followed by a number of affiliates of the PAC, you know, people who I understand to be staffers that contribute to the PAC's work were following these accounts. So was Jason Kwan, who is OpenAI's chief strategy officer. Priscilla Haynes' boss, who oversees their kind of global affairs policy.
Jason Kwan is Priscilla Haynes' boss?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
And he was following both of these accounts. And not only are both of these accounts like small, I think they had 1,300 and 600 followers respectively. They're not super obviously linked to each other. They like responded to each other a couple times, but otherwise you wouldn't have a...
Wait, these are the fake Doomer and the fake anti-Doomer accounts?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so like, you know, they're small accounts that are kind of hard to link to each other. And also just post obnoxious slop. It's like not the kind of thing that most sophisticated people want to be seeing on their Twitter feed. And Jason Kwan is following both of them before he wrote about it. And so it's like, you know, there's a very like real question that I think he should answer of like, how did he come across those accounts? And the reason I bring this up is because that third sock puppet account that we had disclosed months earlier, that was not either of these two, but it was a third one that... also was kind of anti-Doomer in nature. It had less than 100 followers. And like one of those followers was Anna Brockman, the wife of Greg Brockman, was, you know, one of the major donors to this PAC. And so, you know, Leading the Future has tried to blame these kind of astroturfing efforts on rogue vendors that have gone off and, you know, done things either without their permission or, you know, like in some way external to them. And OpenAI has said, we have no visibility into what they do. And therefore, you know, you shouldn't hold us accountable for their astroturfing. Implicitly, that's what they're saying. And if true, I have a lot of questions about like how these specific people found these accounts. The last thing I'll mention related to this is this third sock puppet I mentioned. At one point, it tweeted in ways that I think could only be explained by information being fed from OpenAI to this account. What had happened was the journalist Emily Sugarman in the San Francisco Standard had written a piece about this kind of AstroTurf child safety coalition that OpenAI had kind of quietly funded. And once it came out that OpenAI was behind it, there was a lot of drama within the coalition. And this, you know, sock puppet Doomer account that I associate with Leading the Future, it did a whole thread about this story, attacking it and saying like, oh, well, you know, in this child safety coalition, all these specific groups that presumably took umbrage with OpenAI, all these specific groups have bad qualities or they're associated with Anthropic or something. None of the groups that account mentioned were named in the initial reporting. It's almost like it made an unforced error where it started kind of like spilling all the details of whatever opposition research doc it has on these groups without realizing that there was no plausible way for it to publicly identify who these groups were. And so like, you know, I'm still at a loss for how that happened, but my best guess is that the sort of OpenAI Global Affairs team that I think was probably responsible for this AstroTurf Child Safety Coalition that is led by Chris Lehane, who advised Greg Brockman's donation, that, you know, there's a lot, there's a group chat where they're all going back and forth with like, here's the account that we started up. Here's some details about Emily Sugarman's story, stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. I mean, so I guess, you know, as we said, OpenAI said, well, we don't donate money to this. Greg Brockman does. I'm kind of surprised that at this point they haven't just kind of cut, in effect, cut ties. Like Greg Brockman could say, you know, in retrospect, I didn't realize how far these guys were going to go. This is a mistake. We it's fine for us to support, you know, honest information about the downside of regulation, blah blah blah. But we you know, if I had thought this through, I wouldn't have done this, period, right? And just kind of stop it and like, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to advocate that anyone get fired who's running a nefarious organization, but just kind of cut ties with Nathan Lemur. Yeah. But they haven't, I mean, what have they done to, what has Greg Brockman done to justify his undeniable connection to all this? Has he suggested he didn't really know what they were going to be doing or anything like that?
I don't think he has done a denial of the sort that OpenAI has tried to do. You know,
well, Chris Lehane can't do the kind they did because he did give money.
Yeah.
but
it's true.
Yeah.
I recall seeing like him responding to Dean Ball on Twitter a few weeks ago and saying that, you know, my goal in donating to this operation was to support sensible legislation. And I think he said, I'm glad to see that they endorsed this recent bill in Illinois that passed, because I think that this PAC is starting to change their tune and take a bit more of a favorable stance towards certain regulation in light of the kind of failures that they've experienced so far. Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen him address the astroturfing. And the question is especially pertinent because my understanding is that Greg Brockman has committed $50 million to the Super PAC, but only distributed $25. And yeah. So unless he is in some sort of contractual obligation to disperse the remaining 25, you would think that at a minimum, he would want to make that remaining funding conditional on some changes, whether it's just stopping all these nonsense tactics or a change in leadership or whatever. You might even hope he would go further and just not pay out the remaining 25. Yeah.
It's funny, in Karen Howe's book, Empire of AI, as I recall, Greg Brockman comes off, and first of all, I should say he's clearly very smart in ways I'm not and all that, but he comes off as kind of a blunt instrument in certain respects, you know, just in terms of like, you know, conducting himself within the company and so on, just like not as smooth as Sam Altman, for example, I would say.
I think that's right, yeah, and I do think that, like, you know, there is a detail in the recent Florida lawsuit against OpenAI that I believe Greg Brockman was the person who, like, in 2019 or 2020 suggested starting a bidding war between the major powers to, you know, monetize this AI project that they were doing. Like, let's see if we can get Russia or China or the US to pay us the most for this technology.
I mean, I will say in his defense on that, that when I read that, it seemed to me like one of those things that, you know, I've been in journalism for a while. One of those things where to read the account that we have access to of that, you really don't know. I mean, OpenAI said is, well, they were brainstorming and throwing out wild ideas. I kind of thought, you know, I really don't know that that's not the case. It was one of those descriptions where I'd really want to know more about the context and exactly what he said. On the other hand, other things I've seen about him suggest that maybe he would just say, hey, let's do this. Let's start a bidding war among countries for our, what was the idea, that we'll have this kind of, we'll be the most promising AI company or something, and then countries can bid for us? What?
Yeah.
I forget the details, but
the extent of my understanding was that there's just this big challenge they had and still have about how to monetize this extremely capital intensive project. And I think the idea was, well, you get the various countries to bid each other up and how much they're willing to pay to support a project like this.
Well, I've had some pretty crazy revenue generation ideas. Unfortunately, I've tried some of them and they didn't work, but I've never had that exact thought. I'll give that one a shot. Yeah. So, as you know, Tyler, we generally do about, what have we done? We're at 46 minutes. We do a long conversation for the public, then we go into overtime, available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, link in the show notes. You can go to nonzero.org, find this post, and sign up that way. And thereafter, if you want, you can set up a podcast feed that will always have access to the overtime segments, where we sometimes get even spicier, believe it or not, than we do in the public parts. Before we go, is there anything else you want to say about your thing, or make any appeals for people to share and like your content or anything? And
yeah,
rate and review.
You can find what we're doing at themidasproject.com or the Midas Project on Twitter. This most recent piece was co-authored with Taylor Lorenz, who's done some great work on this. So you can find her at UserMag on Substack. And if you're just curious about, like, what's going on with these super PACs, there's some great stuff out there. Maybe my favorite piece of writing on it was from Scott Alexander, and it's a bit dated now, but he's a great piece called The Tech PACs Are Closing In on the Altmans. And if you want to know what that means, maybe you have to stick around into overtime.
On the Altmans or on the
almonds, like the nut.
Almonds.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we got that distinction straightened out before who knows what happened. Okay, so in overtime, you're going to explain to me what the hell that means. That's one reason for people to become paid subscribers. I also want to talk about Anthropic a little more. You referred to them as China hawks, certainly Dario Amodeus, and I'd like to talk about this recent nod by Anthropic to the possibility of a global pause in that context. And also, I'm going to make my guess, which is probably a pretty obvious guess, about how the name Midas Project came about and what it refers to. And then we'll talk about other stuff. So I hope everybody will join us. But if not, thanks for following us this far. And now we are heading into overtime.